This podcast is presented to you by a new series, the Clergy Confessions Podcast, now available wherever you get your podcast. Listen to ministers share truly awful experiences in anonymity. In this first season, you will hear stories of a minister fighting for maternity leave deep into her pregnancy, a pastor being fired for discovering an embezzlement scheme by the deacon board, an associate pastor finding his senior pastor and office administrator having an affair on church property, and so much more. Visit clergyconfessions.com. Follow Clergy Confessions on Instagram, Facebook, and whatever Twitter's called now.
Much has been made, the last decades of the nuns and duns. However, well before these words, entered into our lexicon, the church was already experiencing rapid decline. Maybe we just didn't notice it. From 1937 through 1999, religious participation in the United States hovered around 70% or higher, according to Gallup. However, religious participation has steadily declined at the turn of the century, with 9.2% of adults exiting each decade. To make that even more abundantly clear, the U.S. mainline Protestant population was 31% in 1967, but 12% in 2022. When you first started looking into these numbers, what was your first response to them?
Welcome to the CBF Podcast Conversation. We know that conversations matter, so each week we are grinding through the critical research to bring you the best stories and resources of people doing groundbreaking and innovative work in renewing God's world. I'm Andy Hale, your CBF podcast host, and this year we're celebrating our 7th year of the podcast, bringing you even better interviews worth your time, attention, and collaboration. These episodes are not intended for you to listen to an island unto yourself. Get online, share your insights, thoughts, and feedback from the podcast with us on CBF's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages. We also want you to join the CBF podcast community through our CBF podcast listener support page at cbf.net/podcast support. We see you, Pasadena, California, Louisville, Kentucky, Beaverton, Oregon, and Frankfurt, Germany. First-time listeners and long-time listeners, we are grateful you are here for the conversation. We want to give a special shout out to some of our listener supporters.
The Honorable Charles Qual, Caroline Bell, Cindy Foldenlohr, Trip Hawthorne, Bill Johnson, Carson Fushi, Ralph Stocks, and that generous anonymous donor that keeps giving in honor of CBF Grump. Thanks for listening, Little Rock, Arkansas, Pittsburgh, PA, Ashburn, Virginia, West Yellowstone, Montana, Tamworth, Australia, and Hamilton, Canada. First-time listeners and long-time listeners, we are grateful you are here for the conversation. And before we move on, we need to give a word of gratitude to our annual sponsors, including Zondervan Media Company,
Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work,
Baptist Seminary of Kentucky,
A Model Ministry,
and Gardner-Webb University's School of Divinity. Finally, and I promise this is it, don't forget to like and share this episode on your favorite social media platforms.
We need to pause to tell you about one of our annual sponsors,
Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity. The Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity aims to equip, nurture, encourage, and support men and women for their best service in the kingdom of God. Offering several programs, including master's and doctoral levels, you'll be equipped and encouraged to discover the unique place where your faith reaches out to meet the needs of the world. Now enrolling for fall of 2023, for more information about Gardner-Webb Divinity Program, scholarships, and grants, call 704-406-3205 and visit gardner-webb.edu.
Our guest for this week's CBF podcast conversation is Dr. Ryan Berg. He is the assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He's written extensively for Politics and Religion and the Journal of Scientific Study of Religion. He's also authored several books, including The Nuns and 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. Ryan, thank you for joining the conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, we know you're writing, which we're going to get into here in just a bit. Outside of, the doctoral title and, the whole big thing of teaching at an institution, what would you want folks to know about you?
Oh, man. I don't know. It's a weird world I live in, being a social scientist and a pastor at the same time. Not many people, check both those boxes, but I don't know anything else. It's all I've been doing since I was been a pastor since I was 20 years old. I was in grad school when I was 23, and I've been doing both for basically most of my adult life. And I think it actually gives me some great insights. I think it makes me a better pastor, and I think it makes me a better social scientist at the same time. So I think that's like my unfair advantage is that I do both.
Yeah, you know, obviously I skipped that part of the intro because I thought it would be a kind of a unique twist on, you know, the field that you lead in academically, but you also are part of the American Baptist tradition. So kind of walk us through how you, you know, juggle both of those roles and how they also fit well together.
Yeah, so I grew up Southern Baptist in a pretty traditional evangelical home. In the 1990s, I was born in 1982, so I really went through evangelicalism at its absolute numerical peak in the 1990s. And then I went to a free Methodist college called Greenville. Greenville University is what it's called now. And I really got a job at the ABC kind of by accident. I needed a summer gig, and I found out through one of my religion profs that there was a local church about 20 minutes from where I grew up that needed a three-month youth ministry intern. And it was First Baptist Church, which is what I went to, just in a different town. So after a couple of weeks at the new church, I realized we were ABC USA, not SBC. And the three months turned into 3 years. And I didn't really intend for that to happen. But and then whenever I left that church, I got called by a little church in Marion, Illinois to be there for their senior pastor, which is I'm putting that in air quotes because there was only about 30 people in that congregation. They were all, I think I was 24 at the time, and they were all in their 80s. So that was a weird juxtaposition. And I was there for a year. And actually, I tried to walk away from ministry at one point because I was going to grad school. And then another church, First Baptist of Mount Vernon, called me because they didn't have a pastor. And I preached for them, I think, two or three Sundays in a row. And then they said, hey, would you like to be our interim pastor? And I said, I guess. And so I've been their pastor now since 2006. I just finished my 17th year of service at First Baptist in Mount Vernon. And I think, you know, a lot of what I do is just trying to figure out what I'm seeing, you know, from the pulpit every Sunday, which is that when I got to my current church, there were 50 people there. And then all of a sudden there were 30 people there. And now on a good Sunday, we might have 15, but on an average Sunday, we might have 10. And so a lot of what I do intellectually and from an academic perspective is just try to figure out like what is happening to me and my church, but religion more generally. So, you know, I think I understand religion as both a practitioner, but also I try to understand it as sort of an objective academic. And I think that makes my research a little more interesting for a general audience because I'm always thinking from the eyes of a pastor or a denominational leader or just a lay person who's interested in religion, as opposed to just an academic who's only trying to write for, you know, 12 other academics who write in your field. So last couple of years, I've really pivoted to being a more public academic, to use a phrase, and writing more for the general population to try to, you know, teach them, show them more about how social science understands religion.
Well, let's dive right into it because you've got a new book. You've collaborated with Jim Davis and Michael Graham, The Great De-Churching. This book examines who is actually leaving the church, the reasons behind their departure, and some challenging questions about what it would take to bring them back. You wrote, speaking from a purely statistical perspective, the future of the American church looks bleak. In the 1970s, pastors and denominational leaders could look across the pews on a Sunday morning and see a lot of young families because nearly a third of the young people were faithfully attending. That share has been cut in half now. What's the motivation behind your research?
Yeah, I'm just an insanely curious person. And my wife gets so frustrated with me because I'm always saying, like, why do we do things that way? Or like, why is it that way? I'm always like looking at the world and trying to understand why things are the way they are. And you know, we've seen the biggest change. I think that the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, is the largest cultural change in my lifetime, without a shadow of a doubt. About 40 million people have de-churched, meaning they used to go to church once a month. Now they go seldom or never, just in the last 30 years or so. I mean, there were more people de-churched in the last three decades than people who were added to the church through the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, and every Billy Graham crusade combined. So we've seen this massive cultural shift in America, And I think for whatever reason, academics don't write about religion a lot. They don't think about religion a lot. It definitely doesn't make the mainstream. The kind of work I was doing when I was trying to publish in academic journals would almost never make it into like a general field journal. It'd always be like a subfield journal. So I want to try to like surface a lot of these questions that a lot of people have, because I think it's just practical. Like these are questions that the average person has, not the academic or the someone sitting in the ivory tower, but just a guy who goes to church every Sunday and sees fewer and fewer people in the pews. And so I want to help. I love the moment of revelation where I can say, oh, here's why this is happening, and here's the data that shows that. And when people in the audience, you see their eyes light up and the wheels start turning in their brain, they go, oh, that all makes sense to me. Like those moments of revelation are really what really motivates me to continue to do the kind of work I'm doing.
We can't go any further without telling about one of our annual sponsors, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky. How does your congregation handle ministry staff leadership for areas such as youth and children's ministry? More and more churches are cultivating these leaders from within their congregations. Going away to seminary is not an option for these persons, yet many desire some level of theological education to better prepare them for their ministry role. In response to this trend, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky has launched the Homegrown Initiative. The Homegrown Initiative offers ministry leaders options for training and growth that fits into their busy schedules. If you or someone else at your church is serving as a homegrown minister and is looking to be better equipped as a minister, visit bsk.edu to learn more about new creative options for growth. bsk.edu. That's bsk.edu.
Much has been made, the last decades of the nuns and duns. However, well before these words, entered into our lexicon, the church was already experiencing rapid decline. Maybe we just didn't notice it. From 1937 through 1999, religious participation in the United States hovered around 70% or higher, according to Gallup. However, religious participation has steadily declined at the turn of the century, with 9.2% of adults exiting each decade. To make that even more abundantly clear, the U.S. mainline Protestant population was 31% in 1967, but 12% in 2022. When you first started looking into these numbers, what was your first response to them?
Yeah, the mainline collapse is something that I will never, ever fully like be okay with. If you just think about the numbers in the 1950s, some historians say that as many as half of all Americans were part of a mainline Protestant tradition. So United Methodist Episcopalian, United Church of Christ, ABC USA, PC USA, ELCA, and Disciples of Christ. I mean, those denominations absolutely dominated every aspect of American life, religion, politics, culture, all of it. And now the mainline is gone from 50% to 10%, like you said. Very soon, probably going to be in the 6-7% range, because the average mainline Protestant now is over the age of 60 years old. If you look at the Episcopalians, for instance, there's only 300,000 or so who go to church every Sunday. I mean, in a denomination that's nationwide, compare that to the Southern Baptist Convention that has 13.2 million members, and about half of them report going to church every week. So 6 million Southern Baptists are in church on an average weekend, and 300,000 Episcopalians. So, this huge chunk of what the average American Christian looked like was mainline Protestant 30 or 40 years ago. And in 20 years, no one's even going to know what a mainline Protestant is, because many of those denominations are going to have to close down in my lifetime, because they just can't keep the lights open, only having, 500,000 members when they used to have 5 million members. So I think that's probably, along with the nuns, I think that's probably one of, if not the biggest change in how we understand American religion, because at the same time the mainline has collapsed, evangelicalism has not declined that significantly in comparison. Still today, 22% of Americans are part of an evangelical tradition. The Southern Baptists are still 13 million people, although they're down 3 million from their peak. But non-denominationals, who are almost always evangelical, are over 21 million at best count. So there's still a ton of evangelical Protestants in American life, and they seem to dominate the conversation in American life about, what religion is, especially when we talk about politics and culture. So it's almost like young people have no conception of any type of Christianity except evangelical Christianity. And that it's never been that way in American life. Evangelicalism's always been there, but it's been part of the conversation, not dominating the conversation like it does right now.
Let's talk about how we accurately track this data. You wrote, almost every large religious tradition has been tracking their total membership for decades as a means of understanding where churches are growing and where they are declining. Anyone who's been a church administrator for a while knows that membership records are far from accurate. Churches don't want to call people from the rolls because there's always the possibility that they will return from the church one day and express offense when seeing their name has been purged from the official records. You know, tracking membership is a fascinating thing. At the same time, when I was pastoring a new church, we kept no records of membership, reporting nothing to our association. In fact, I don't even think CBF has ever asked churches for their membership numbers. So how do we accurately track this data?
Yeah, the answer is we can't with the specificity that anyone wants. And this is not just Christian denominations, by the way. You should see all the comments I get on Twitter when I post information about Latter-day Saint membership. Let's say they're like, oh, well, you know, it's really hard to leave a Latter-day Saint church. You have to get a notarized form that has to be signed by a notary to do so. So they make it almost impossible to leave one of their congregations. We know that membership data is bad, but there's no evidence that it's systematically worse for certain groups versus other groups. It's bad amongst everyone. So what we do is we triangulate that with survey data, which is basically we just ask you personally, you know, what is your religious tradition? If you say you're Protestant, then we say, okay, what type? Baptist, Methodist, Lutheran, Episcopalian. Then you say Baptist, and then we would say, okay, what type of Baptist are you? And then give you several, you know, four or five different options: free will, Southern, American, cooperative. And then you would choose from that point. So you can sort of use multiple streams of data to get closer to the actual answer. But we know that people, when it comes to religion, don't have a really sophisticated understanding of where they are. And to even complicate matters more from a survey perspective, a lot of people go to a church called The Bridge or Gateway or, you know, Fox Creek. And that might be a Southern Baptist church, but you would never know it by going to that church because they don't talk about it from the pulpit. And there's no, you know, literature about being part of the SBC. So in that situation, that person might say they're non-denominational when really they're Southern Baptist because they just have never learned they're Southern Baptist. So this is a really, probably the hardest part about religion is just basic measurement stuff. But in my work, I try to bring in several different data sets using different metrics and different methodologies to try to get closer to the right answer. At some point, I have adopted this mantra that the perfect is the enemy of the good. And we will never be able to get a perfect approximation of American religion. But I think we have a pretty good approximation of American religion by using both surveys and membership data at the same time. But I'm always in the back of my mind thinking, well, this data is not exactly accurate, but I don't know how to make it more accurate. So this is, we got to go with what we got. And this is as good as it gets for us.
You know, despite the declining church attendance over the last few decades, that didn't stop us from building. You know, many churches, campuses, and organizational structures were designed for a specific era of abundance, including the necessity of replicable Sunday school, you know, rooms, expansive sanctuaries, large gathering spaces for fellowship, and even recreational areas. It made sense for most churches at the time of our continued expansion. But considering the decline in religious participation and the financial impact of those leaving, which is, you know, approximately estimated at $1.4 trillion, there's a couple questions here. You know, have you done much work around the current trajectory of the financial ramifications of the great dechurching in the coming decade?
So I will give you an interesting anecdote about that. The Episcopal Church is one that I think about a lot because they are really good about numbers. They release all kinds of statistics every year, not just about membership and not just about attendance, but also things like baptisms and confirmations and burials and weddings. But they also release this thing called plate and pledge, which is how much money people actually put in the plate and how much they're pledging to put in the plate that year. And here's a fascinating fact about the Episcopal Church. Their attendance is dropping precipitously year over year, but their giving has actually increased at the same time. So the amount, if you divide the amount of plate and pledge by the number of regular attenders, that number has jumped nearly 50% over the last 10 years, which means the people that are left are actually giving more than they used to give. That's the only way that math works out. So, you know, the Episcopal Church is in this really interesting situation where they're going to have not very many people, but they're going to have a lot of money going forward. And the Episcopal Church, for instance, in New York City, Trinity Episcopal Church, which was, you know, founded in the 1600s, actually the land was given to them by Queen Anne. They have so much real estate in Midtown Manhattan that in 2017, the interest off their investments was over $300 million. So that's a denomination, right, where the membership is going to collapse, but the money is going to be there for a long time. And I think there's actually a lot of denominations that are, they have to make a harder decision. An easy decision is we have to close because there's no money in the piggy bank and we can't afford to pay the light bill or pay a director or pay for buildings. A harder decision is we have to close because we just don't have enough people to justify spending all this money on the light bill and the building and everything else. So I think for a lot of denominations, what they're going to struggle with going forward is when to pull the plug, because the money's going to be there, but the people won't. Now, there are other denominations, like, for instance, mine, the American Baptist Church, where we don't have a ton of money. And so the reason my church is going to close when we close in probably the next 12 months is because we just can't afford, the money's gone. And that's actually a really easy decision for us, because you look at the account and go, well, we're burning this amount of money and we have this amount of money left. So let's just do a simple math equation and figure out when the money's gone. So I think denominations are in totally different spots. Some have lots of people and not a lot of money. Some have a lot of money and not a lot of people. But I think for some, buildings become an anchor. They become a weight, an albatross that pulls them down because they have to support and maintain buildings that were built 50, 60, 70 years ago that are not in good shape now. And for instance, my building, we had to give it away. We have a 16,000 square foot facility on 8 acres of ground. It appraised for $400,000. The rebuild cost was over $2 million. We put it on the market for other people to potentially buy. And the best offer we got was $150,000, which is like $1 a foot or $10 a foot. That's nothing, you know? So we had to give it away because we couldn't withstand the $25,000 of maintenance and utilities and insurance every year. And I think a lot of congregations are in the same spot that we're in, while other congregations have plenty of money in the piggy bank. And now it becomes a question of when do we close because of membership, not because of money.
We are pausing to tell you about one of our collaborative annual sponsors, A Model Ministry. Are you a church leader who's committed to keeping children safe? If so, then A Model Ministry is for you. We are a registered nonprofit organization specializing in safety education, policy writing, and risk assessment to mitigate child abuse in ministry organizations. We understand that child safety is a top priority for churches, and we are here to create a safe and nurturing environment for all children. Our founders can provide the resources and support needed to implement effective child safety policies and procedures. Visit amodelministry.com to learn more about our services and how we can help keep children safe.
Since 2016, CBF episodes of interviews with authors and practitioners for conversations that matter. These stories of creativity and innovation have garnered weekly support from around the United States and the world. We are inviting you, the listeners, to join us in connecting with the podcast. Become a monthly listener supporter and receive some perks, including name recognition on the podcast, questions for upcoming guests, free books from the podcast, joining the podcast for an interview, and a VIP experience with the General Assembly podcast guest. There are 5 levels of listener support, starting at $5 per month. For less than the cost of a pumpkin spice latte, you will be featured by name on the weekly podcast episode. For more information and to join the community of listener supporters, visit cbf.net/podcast support.
I'm going to come back to financial peace in just a second when it comes to misconception around certain generations and giving. But, you know, we know why people are leaving. So first, can you give us some of the considerable reasons and then we'll begin to break them down?
Yeah, so I really put those into two separate buckets. And the great de-churching, I think, does a great job of this. You know, like we have a whole section called casual de-churching. And that's the one that doesn't get nearly enough play when we talk about this topic. And casual dechurching is people who leave for very boring reasons, you know, very logistical reasons. For instance, they moved. That's actually the number one reason why people dechurched in our sample was because they moved. And the question there is, okay, so why, you know, why that lead to dechurching? Because they left the home church they grew up in, had to find a new church, and said, that's not worth it, not worth my time. Or they got married, or they had kids, or they changed jobs, or their schedule changed in some ways. So a lot of people leave for just nuts and bolts reasons of it just did not work with the time that I have and the schedule that I have. So that's a really significant part of dechurching is just that bucket of people. The other bucket is people that get a lot more play in the media, which is I left because of a theological dispute, you know, things about how we interpret the Bible, but also things about, you know, sexuality and gender. Like I came out as LGBTQ and my church did not accept me, or my child came out as gay and my church did not accept me. Those are the kind of disputes that tend to get a lot more media attention. Politics, you know, my pastor started getting political from the pulpit and talking about Donald Trump or about Joe Biden or about abortion or about whatever. And I just got up one day and left and never came back. Those are way more dramatic. And I think they're way more interesting and they get a lot more eyeballs. And that does happen. You know, don't get me wrong. People leave because they're abused. You know, that kind of falls in that same bucket too. But those people are a smaller number overall of dechurch people than people who left for logistical reasons. It's just the logistical reasons don't make the headlines of the New York Times. So you've got to realize that dechurching doesn't work the same way for everyone. For some people, it's abrupt. It's like this stochastic event where they were going every week for 5 years and then they just stopped going entirely because they had this political dispute or this theological dispute. For a lot of people, they were going every week for a while, then they were going twice a month for a while, then once a month, then once every 3 months, and then once every 6 months, and then once a year, and then they stopped going at all. That is the norm, is this slow slide away from religion over time. And that is actually in some ways a more difficult nut to crack than the theological or political disputes where people, you know, were going a bunch and now aren't going a bunch. So I think we have to be very careful in thinking that, like, no two people leave for exactly the same reason, and some leave for very boring reasons, and some leave for very salacious reasons.
What would you say is the most misunderstood or overblown reason for, you know, the people give for why they think people are leaving the church?
Yeah, I think, you read the headlines of like, well, my pastor went full MAGA and now I'm out. Like, I think those are really interesting narratives. And like, I'll listen to that podcast. I've listened to a bunch of podcasts about that. But the reality is a couple things about that. The biggest one for me is that if anyone who's ever pastored a church before, especially in the Baptist tradition, which is what I've been in my entire life, in the Baptist tradition, the local church has full autonomy in who they can hire and fire, who becomes their pastor. That is called by the local congregation. So that means that when you get in the pulpit every Sunday, your constituency is sitting in the pews, and if you say something that makes enough of them mad, they can fire you that day. And in many situations, you've got no legal recourse. You've got no severance. You've got no way to sue. I mean, they can fire you for the color of your hair, and, you know, discrimination laws don't apply to you because you're a pastor. So most pastors are not being political from the pulpit. We know that statistically. We ask weekly churchgoers, we give them a list of like 10 different things, political things that could have been addressed from the pulpit, everything from immigration to healthcare to just voting, you know, general voting. And we said, in the last 12 months, how many of these issues have you heard? And they can check all the boxes that apply. The number one response option, 1/3 of people in that sample pick none of the above. And over half of them picked none of the above or one out of that list of 10. So 52% of weekly churchgoers said they heard one issue or zero issues from the pulpit. So very few churches are talking about politics in a pervasive way on a regular basis. I mean, I think in most churches, and I grew up in church, this is something that the divide that really blows my mind. You can tell people who grew up in church versus those who didn't by how they think about this issue. People who didn't grow up in church think churches are, they think that evangelical churches are political meetings. And I'm like, I don't know if you've ever been to an evangelical church before, but most pastors hardly ever talk about politics from the pulpit. So I think that's the biggest disconnect. A lot of non-Christian people or not people who haven't gone to worship in a long time think that politics is in and through evangelical churches all the time, and it's really not. And they use that as a basis for saying, well, people are leaving the church because of politics. Some people are. But I think the majority of people probably are just leaving for other logistical reasons. I just think it's, I hate to like, you know, to malign the media, but the best religion reporters are typically people who grew up religious and or still religious now, because they see it from the inside, not the outside. And a lot of people who grew up like in the Beltway or in the Acela corridor that runs from DC to Boston, they didn't grow up religious, so they don't understand it as an insider. They only try to understand it as an outsider, and that means they create these narratives that just are not true according to the data and the real experiences of people across America.
Cultural fracturing is a tremendous factor with increased polarization and erosion of trust in institutions. Why is the church not, you know, not necessarily the victim of being caught in the crosshair of all these things, but plays, you know, an equal part in polarization and eroding of trust?
Yeah, because I think we've shot ourselves in the foot multiple times over the last 30 or 40 years. I mean, it doesn't take a deep dive into American history, recent American religious history, to see, you know, go back to Jim Baker and go back to Jerry Falwell, but then also, you know, go to the Catholic Church and the sex abuse cover up, which now morphed into the Southern Baptist Convention sex cover up. But then even stories like, you know, the plumber who found, you know, $70,000 in cash in the wall of a bathroom in Joel Osteen's church in Houston, Texas. I mean, all these stories continue to come out about, you know, religious people doing dumb things, doing immoral things. And that fits this larger narrative that's going on in American culture right now, especially amongst young people. Cynicism is at all-time highs. We distrust institutions across the board. Almost every generation distrusts almost every institution less today than they did 20 years ago. The only exception is the military. But banks, unions, big business, government, religion, we all trust that stuff less. And those stories I was just telling you about are, you know, accelerate that distrust and that cynicism. So I think what's happened is, there used to be a smaller gulf between where the average non-church-going person was and their likelihood of going back to church. They were actually kind of on the fence, I think, a lot of them, about going back. Now, because of all these stories, all this cynicism, and all this institutional distrust, I think there's much taller walls now between the likelihood of the average non-church-going person going back than's ever been before, because they think church is full of people who are trying to make money or abusing people. It's all about power. When that's not really what's happening, you know, like I like to tell people that the media does not report about the planes that land safely, because it happens tens of thousands of times a day across the globe. 99.99% of pastors do their job as best they can. They don't steal money. They don't abuse people. They are just trying to, you know, steer a congregation through a difficult time. They really are good people. Unfortunately, you hear the story about the 1 in 10,000 pastors who does something terrible, and then that you transfer that into all pastors. So I think, you know, the media makes it harder for us, but also we are predisposed towards bad news and cynicism. And so it's kind of created this toxic stew that's built this big barrier between religion and the average person. And I don't think it's easy to overcome that, to be honest with you. I think that those are structural things that are hard to fight against. And no matter how hard church tries, it's probably not going to be able to fight that negativity bias that exists in the media.
Sexual orientation is a huge factor, with either some feeling the church is too restrictive of their sexual freedom, or because they don't feel they or someone they care about is welcome, or because their churches didn't adequately talk about the complexities of these issues. Just how big is sexual orientation as a factor in why people are leaving?
Yeah, it's certainly a factor. Identifying exactly how big that factor is actually really hard, because, you know, it's hard to rank order why you left religion. You know, for some people, it's clear, like I'm gay and I grew up Southern Baptist. I can't go to church there because they don't allow that. But for a lot of people, it's like a sympathetic thing. Like, I won't go to church because I have friends who are gay and church is anti-LGBTQ. what's really interesting that kind of undergirds this whole conversation is views of same-sex marriage have changed dramatically in the American population over the last, even since 2004, so the last 20 years or so. So the average, in 2004, a third of Americans were approving of same-sex marriage. Now it's about two-thirds are approving of same-sex marriage. But even amongst Catholics, it's above 50%. Amongst mainline Protestants, above 50%. Above evangelicals, it's not above 50%. But amongst younger evangelicals, 18 to 35-year-olds, it is above 50%. So, you know, the question I often ask evangelical pastors is, why do your people not believe you when you talk about sexuality, that you teach the same ethic that your church has taught for decades now about one man and one woman, and that's what marriage is? Why do so many people who sit in your pews and still identify as evangelical, why have they changed their mind on the issue of same-sex marriage over the last 10 or 15 years? Why are you not more persuasive in that whole thing? And actually, I think you're seeing sort of the first fruits of those changes happening already with churches. Churches, when I grew up in the 1990s, I mean, we talk about gay people all the time, it felt like, in Sunday school and Bible study, and even from the pulpit every once in a while. If you sort of like keep your ear to the ground of evangelical world, most evangelical pastors don't talk about homosexuality very much anymore because they realize it's a losing issue. So I think for a lot of churches, they're just going to like, it's like a don't ask, don't tell situation going forward. And I think that actually might help them bring in some younger people. By the way, younger people by default are pro-LGBTQ. There's almost none, like 25% don't think same-sex marriage should be allowed amongst 18 to 25-year-olds. So, you know, those churches are not going to actively change their doctrinal statements. They're just going to stop talking about it. And that will, I think, in some ways turn that church more towards acceptance. But I don't know how long a church can hold the line on this issue when the culture is in a completely different spot. You know, a lot of churches say, well, we're gonna hold to biblical values. And you can do that for sure. And you will attract some people who are hardcore conservatives. But the median person is not in 10 years is not going to go to a church where it says that marriage is between one man and one woman. That's just not going to be palatable for a lot of young people because they might be gay or they certainly have friends who are gay. So I think it puts church in this really difficult spot of like, how much do you change? How you change strategically? How do you do that while still appealing to your congregation or potential new members? It's not an easy thing to do.
All right, let's ask a very simple question. Who is leaving and what is the most common generation departing from institutional religion, and which denomination is declining the fastest?
Okay, so who is leaving? The answer is everyone. I'm actually working on a post for my Substack that'll come out next week where I'm just trying to find any demographic group in America that goes to church more now than they did 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, I'm looking at age, I'm looking at race, I'm looking at gender, I'm looking at education, I'm looking at income, I'm looking at everything I can find to try to find a group where they're attending more now or even the same now as they attended 15 years ago. And the answer is it's almost impossible to find a group that's attending more now than they were a decade ago. So everyone is leaving. Now, there are some groups that are leaving the fastest, and it's actually probably not the groups a lot of people think about. The group that is leaving the fastest are people with a high school degree or less who make $50,000 a year or less. Those people are leaving church at a faster rate than any other combination of income and education. So when people think about religion, oftentimes they think about it's for poor people, it's for uneducated people. But the data doesn't say that. The data actually says that the people who are most likely to go to church are people who make middle-class incomes with a four-year college degree. It's people at the bottom end of the socioeconomic spectrum that are leaving religion behind at the fastest rate. So that blows people away in terms of misconceptions about, you know, demography and religion and things like that. So what denomination is declining the fastest? From a pure numeric perspective, the United Methodists are, and that's because they've had this terrible split that's happened over the last 2 years or so. And, you know, the data is still coming in like every single day about churches disaffiliating from the United Methodist Church. At one point, they had 8 million members about 5 years ago. I wouldn't be surprised at all in 5 years that they have 4 million members because of not because people died or because their church left the United Methodist Church and joined the Global Methodist Church. So, you know, that schism is going to make the largest mainline church in America about half the size that it was just 5 or 10 years ago. So the other one is the Southern Baptist Convention. In 2006, 16.2 million members in the SBC. That was their absolute numerical peak in 2006. Today, the SBC has about 13.2 million members. They've lost over a million members in the last 3 years. To put that in perspective, the Presbyterian Church USA has 1.1 million members total right now, and the SBC lost 1.2 million in the last 3 years. So from a pure numeric perspective, the United Methodists have lost, but they've lost through schism. The SBC has lost through defection, people leaving the SBC largely for non-denominational evangelical churches. Those are the ones who are growing the fastest in American life. A lot of mainline have lost, but it's been slow and steady over a long period of time. PCUSA was 3.1 million in 1984. It's 1.1 million today. You're seeing a lot of that in the mainline, by the way. They're losing, they've lost half their membership since the early 1980s. It's just happened very slowly, very gradually over a period of 30 or 40 years. SBC lost 1.1 million in 3 years. So it's happening very, very quickly with the Southern Baptist right now.
You've had a unique role in tracking much of this data over the last few years and then, you know, reporting on it. I can imagine you are met with some folks who are not happy with the reality you are painting.
Yeah. It's, you know, like, I don't want to like put myself in the biblical narrative, but no one liked Jeremiah either. You know, saying the Babylonians are going to destroy you and they didn't listen. And I do kind of feel like a prophet in the wilderness in some ways. But I will say this, I get a lot more people saying, you know, thank you for actually putting data on this in numbers, in statistics, in empirics. We all sort of felt it, but no one really could give us actual percentages and numbers and all those things. So I think the vast majority of responses I get are positive. Where I get real big pushback is when I say, well, this denomination is going to have to go away in the next 20 years. They go, oh, we'll still be around and we'll still, yeah, you will still stick around, but you're going to be in a very weakened state in 20 years. Is that a good thing for you? Shouldn't you think about, you know, ways to die well or to transition in a positive way? And so my goal is just to say, listen, here's what the numbers say. If you don't like it, look at the, you know, get mad at the numbers. Don't get mad at me. I will say this, a lot of times when I give a talk, at the end, whoever moderating will say, could you give us some positive, you know, some good feeling data here that we don't leave here feeling awful about ourselves? And the problem is, it's like, I cannot be statistically accurate in giving them any positive data. There are a few things that are positive in the data, but good gravy. I mean, the overwhelming sense you get is that things are heading down, 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 and ignoring the problem doesn't mean it goes away. It just means it gets worse. And so my job is just to point at the numbers and say, what are you going to do about this? I'm not being prescriptive. I'm being descriptive. And now it's on you to figure out how to move forward in this situation.
Okay, so you have a bunch of clergy listening to this conversation who have this sense of calling to the church, whose financial well-being is wrapped up in the current form of institutionalization. You know, what is a word of caution that you might give them?
Yeah, let's just say this. Precise surgery in time is better than amputation at the last minute. You need to think about cutting your budget 3% this year or 2% this year and 3% the next year and 3% the next year. Think about the possibility of not replacing that person if they leave, or replacing them with a part-time person if they leave. Think about not building a bigger building or adding more maintenance costs or overhead. Don't assume that growth is all you're going to see in the future. Anticipate the possibility, because you know what's way worse is we have to cut half our staff in the next 6 months, or we're not going to be financially solvent. It'd be better if you took 5 years ahead of time and said, okay, we're not going to replace that person. Then you never get to that emergency amputation moment. To me, I always kind of scratch my head when I hear about these churches or denominations saying, oh, we've got to cut staff by 30% in the next 12 months or we can't make it. Like, you saw that coming and you refuse to make the hard decisions along the way. Don't refuse to make the hard decision. Okay. It's no fun. Everyone loves when a church grows. Everyone loves when a denomination grows and an organization grows. You look like a hero and a champion when your church is growing. Dying well is much more important, and it's much more difficult to do. So think about what that means for your denomination, for your congregation, for your community, and prepare for that. Don't, you might not have to act on it, but talk about it. Be very aware of what plans would look like in that direction as well. No one wants to talk about this. No one wants to think about this, but to be a good leader and to be a good shepherd and be a good steward of your resources and your flock, you've got to think in both directions at the same time and have plans that go both ways at the same time.
Let's take a break to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work. What is social work? At Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work, it's empowerment, service, and justice. It's ministry, counseling, and relationship building. It's faith, practice, and community. But above all, it's learning how to help others thrive. Social workers can be found addressing the full scope of the human experience at churches, schools, prisons, government agencies, senior living centers, nonprofits, and Fortune 500 companies. Careers in social work profession are vast and varied. What is social work, you ask? It's much more than you think. Visit gsswstories.baylor.edu to explore more.
I don't want to convey the wrong message here. When we talk about the possibilities of these folks returning, what do you mean by that? And in what context would these people be, quote, returning to church?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the problem with social science is we can't model the likelihood of a nationwide revival, you know, like the next great awakening. That could happen. You know, like that's always a possibility. The Holy Spirit does not work through survey data. So that's always on the table. I'm not precluding the possibility of such a thing happening. I'm saying that if people do come back, I think the reality is that the vast majority of them will never become like the core part of your church. They will be on the periphery. And you've got to ask yourself, are you okay with the fact that you might have a significant portion of your church who comes once a month or once a quarter or three times a year? You know, is that better than them not coming at all? And a lot of those people might not believe everything the church teaches and are not willing to be baptized and are not willing to add their membership to the church roles. They just want to come a couple times a year. Are you okay with that? And from my perspective, I'm always okay with that. I think anyone coming to church once a year is giving them one more opportunity to hear the message and become part of a community. So I don't think we're going to see this, you know, you're not going to add 100 core members of your church in the next 12 months. You might add 50 peripheral members, and that needs to be okay, because enough periphery, you know, that gets butts in seats on Sunday mornings. And I think that gives them more opportunities to build community, find friendship, build a relationship with Jesus Christ. Those things all matter too. But the type of people that are most likely to come back are not the kind of people that are going to be able to financially support your congregation. They're going to be people on the edges of American society, right? Not making a ton of money, not having a lot of employment prospects, probably struggling with their own economic situation. So they're probably going to be more takers than givers. And so you also have to plan for that as well. They're not going to be able to drop a bunch of money in the offering plate. I think those are the kind of people most likely to come back. And from a pure nuts and bolts, dollars and cents perspective, they're probably not going to change the church too much in terms of how much budget they have and how many programs you can do, because they're going to be taking more from your church than giving back. But that's the role of the church, you know, is to serve everyone regardless of their financial situation.
I think there's a big assumption from especially aged congregations that young people are abandoning their faith and fleeing wildly into the world of irreligiosity. However, the more and more post-church young adults I talk to have no inclination of abandoning their spirituality along with their faith in Jesus, just not the Jesus portrayed in many established churches. What's your research telling you?
Yeah, so I just looked at a research report from Springtide Research Institute. They did a survey of over 4,000 people aged 13 to 25 years old, so young people. Only 15% of them said that God doesn't exist. You know, there's still a deep yearning, and even amongst atheists and agnostics, over 40% of atheists said they were still spiritual. So, you know, even amongst agnostics, it was 2/3 said they were spiritual. So the idea that like the younger generation is just walking away from every aspect of religion or spirituality is just false. There is still a baseline level of belief in God in America, in spirituality / and or religion in America, even amongst young people. That desire is still very much there. We are not a secular society from a belief standpoint. Most Americans, almost 90%, believe in God at some level. So it's the institution part of the thing. It's the actual doing part of the religion thing that's really been declining most precipitously. So 40% of Americans never attend church. 30% of Americans don't identify with religious tradition, but only, like we said, about 10 or 12% of Americans say they don't believe in God. There's still a lot of belief out there. It's the belonging and the behavior piece that's gone away the fastest.
You know, as people continue to engage their faith just outside the institutional church, what are some of the most, for lack of better terms, the nuanced versions of church that they are experiencing, and how might that give hope to the church for the future?
So there's a great book by Tara Isabella Burton called Strange Rites. And she writes about how religion and spirituality has been really individualized in the 21st century. You know, people are doing things like horoscopes and tarot and Ouija boards and crystals and saging their homes and things like that. But she also writes about things like group physical fitness, especially things like CrossFit or Orange Theory, spinning classes, where people will go to these. And they go for the physical benefits, the exercise benefits, but they also go for the sense of community that they build in places like that. You know, a lot of CrossFit people, it's almost like a cult. Like, they have this thing called a box. It's not a gym. It's a box is where they go. And it's something they post about on social media a lot and really takes over their lives. So I think people are trying to recreate what church was, just in a different context. And I think what people forget, though, and this is my social science coming to the fore, I am a big believer in a community. Church is a community of people who meet together on a regular basis. And I think we forget that. It's not all spiritual all the time. It doesn't have to be all evangelistic all the time, all religious all the time. Sometimes it's just people sitting around a table at a potluck or a barbecue and just sitting and talking and having company with different people. Like, that is what people are seeking out. And they are seeking that out in other ways in American society. But I think they would be amenable to being part of a community where they seek that out just amongst other, you know, in a church, just with other people, not maybe with the religious piece of it. I think that religious piece is the part they probably push back against the most. People like hanging out, and church gives people opportunity to hang out. So I think there's ways that church could look at what's happening in the culture and go, we can do part of that. We can recreate that social aspect, that community aspect, that communal aspect together. So think about ways to connect what you're seeing in the larger culture to what church could provide if it just tweaked its programming just a little bit.
You know, what's the underlying message to churches out of all this data?
There's a lot of headwinds for American religion right now. All types of American religion. This is not something that's affecting only one, you know, like only the mainline or only evangelicals. It's definitely hurting the mainline worse than evangelicals at this point. But it's harder to be a pastor today than at any point, I think, in American history in some ways. I mean, everything is sort of against you. And I think if your church is not growing or declining, then welcome to the party. Most churches in America are not growing. Depending on what metric you look at, it's between 15 and 25% of churches in America are growing right now, which means the vast majority of churches are not growing right now. So if your church is not growing, then you are the norm in American life. I think what you have to figure out is, how do you operate in a post-religious America? We are, you know, Christianity, Protestant Christianity especially, has been the default for most communities across America for centuries now. And in the future, there's a real possibility the nuns are going to be 40 or 50% of the American population. So how does Christianity operate when it's not the default anymore? When people don't have a biblical understanding of things, they have no concept of the Bible or Jesus. How do you tweak your message, your programming, to a world that knows almost nothing about you except what they read on the news or on social media? So I think, you know, it's harder and harder to be the church, but that does not preclude us from doing the job of being the church. Churches still do tons of good things for American society. They feed hungry kids. They do prison ministry. They take in victims of domestic abuse. Like, there's all these things that churches do. Don't forget that. Continue to do that good work, because that is desperately needed in a country where the haves and the have-nots are getting wider and wider every year. So still be on mission, but realize that if you don't grow, that's normal. That's what the future is going to look like. But how do you operate as the size of church you are well? And serve as many people as you possibly can for as long as you possibly can. That's really the only option that you have. You know, there's this great quote I use in my book from a movie called Wish I Were There. And one guy looks at the other guy and goes, "What are we going to do? Where are we going to go?" And the older guy looks at him and goes, we have to go forward. It's the only way God lets us. That's where we have to go. We have to move forward, because we can't go backward. We can't go sideways. Forward is the only direction God allows. So how do we go forward well? That's the most important question.
Going back to kind of to wrap up our conversation here, a good chunk of our audience is professional clergy. And this reality brings a lot of change, both with their vocational trajectory, their financial trajectory, but also how they lead the church. So what words of hope would you give them?
Yeah, I think the church, I mean, listen, the church has been in exile for many times in its history, right? I mean, the Jewish people were in exile in Babylon for 75 years. There's no reason to despair. Just because your church is not growing and Christianity is declining doesn't mean you can't do all that you have with all that you can for as long as you can. I mean, what's happening at the macro level, you can't have much impact on. You know, that is stuff that is affecting hundreds of millions of people across the world. You can't have an impact on that, but you can have an impact on what happens in your local community. One thing that really guided our church as we moved towards the end of our time as an organization is this simple question. If our church closed down, would anyone outside our membership really care? You know, are we having an impact on the community? And we asked ourselves that question about 12 years ago, and the answer was no at that point. So we started a Brown Bag Friday program. We packed a bag of about 13 items of food that we gave over 250 bags out to kids in our local school district, because we were told by the social workers that lots of kids would have nothing to eat over the weekend. 84% of kids in our local district are on free or reduced lunch, which means poverty is rampant in our local school system. We started doing that, started with 30 bags. And then we kept adding more bags. And then at some point it was, tell me how many kids need this. And they told us a number, and we always met the goal. We're a church where our entire budget is $40,000. And last year we spent $10,000 just on Brown Bag Friday. It's something that sustained us, that gave us hope, and that really changed the lives of people in our community. We became the church that was known for the Brown Bag program. I think even as we are a church in exile, Christianity's in decline, there are ways to have a tangible impact on your community and build the kingdom of God. I would say that one of the roles of religion is to make the world a little less awful. How can your church make the world a little less awful for people who are struggling? Find ways to meet their needs. And if you do that, whether your church grows or declines, it's of no difference, because you are doing the kingdom work that you're called to do. And just focus on doing that kingdom work as best you can, and let the chips fall where they may.
Our guest is Dr. Ryan Berg. The book is The Great De-Churching. You can stay connected with him by visiting ryanberg.net. Ryan, it's always a joy to be with you. Thank you for continuing to challenge us to be the incarnational presence of Christ in our world, despite the fact that Christendom has declined.
Thanks, Andy. It's been a real pleasure.
We are grateful for a chance to pause to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Zondervan Media Group. Explore the depth and beauty of Scripture with the NRSV updated edition. With provisions based on new contextual evidence, historical insights, and linguistic precision, this updated edition of the NRSV delivers a translation of Scripture based on meticulous care for accuracy and readability. Learn more about new editions of the NRSV UE from Zondervan at nrsvuebible.com.
Okay, that's it. That's our conversation.
If you want more, be sure to subscribe to CBF on all major platforms, including iTunes, Amazon Music, Spotify, SoundCloud, and Google Podcast. Don't forget to like and share this episode on your favorite social media platforms. Be sure to support our annual sponsors by visiting their websites. Again, that's Gardner Webb University School of Divinity, a model ministry, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky,
Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work,
and Zondervan Media Company. Check out more at cbf.net for more information about church starters, field personnel, advocacy work, and more. And I'm not sure if we mentioned that you should join the listener support community at cbf.net/podcast support.